The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Andrea Fryrier, author of Mastering Marketing Agility, Transform Your Marketing Teams and Evolve Your Organization, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I produce this podcast to help us both keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow faster by taking a sales-based approach to marketing. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. And if you're one of the many, many listeners who's left a review on Apple Podcasts, I want to drop a little something in the mail to thank you. Details after the interview. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Andrea Fryrier to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about her book, Mastering Marketing Agility, Transform Your Marketing Teams and Evolve Your Organization, published by Barrett Kohler. Andrea Fryrier is an author, international keynote speaker, and the co-founder of Agile Sherpas, an agile marketing training and consulting group. She spends the majority of her time helping marketing organizations from global Fortune 50 enterprises all the way to startups to transform their operations by applying agile principles and practices. She is the co-author of the world's first internationally recognized agile marketing certification. And in addition to Mastering Marketing Agility, which we're going to talk about, Andrea is the author of Death of a Marketer, which chronicles marketing's troubled past and charts a course to its more agile future. And interesting fact, she earned a postgraduate degree from the University of Oxford in England. And while there, she was on the volleyball team. Andrea, congratulations on Mastering Marketing Agility, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much. I have to say, first time anybody has given me the volleyball shout out on a marketing podcast. I like it.
Well, it's a great sport. And you're from Texas originally. I think you got your undergrad in the state of Texas. Did you play volleyball there as well?
I did. I've been an addict since I was 12, nonstop volleyball for, well, we won't give the number of years, but many years.
Well, it's a great sport, and my daughter played it for a while when she was in middle school and high school, and it's really it's a great sport. And it's a lot of fun to watch, and it's I think it's not well served because people might play it at picnics in the U.S. and not realize the athleticism and preparation that goes into it.
Yes, that's true. Like beer picnic volleyball is not the same as, you know, collegiate volleyball, but both fun.
Yes, in their own way. Yes. Well, before we get into Mastering Marketing Agility, tell us briefly about your first book, Death of a Marketer. Clearly, it's a murder mystery.
What happened to marketing? Where has it gone? Yeah, I like to say that Mastering Marketing Agility is sort of the happy ending, the sequel to Death of a Marketer. It was really looking back to sort of see how did we get into this predicament as marketers, looking at more of a historical perspective of where we've been, and then making the argument that because of all of that history and the things that have been happening to change marketing as a profession in the recent digital past, that Agile is really the right route for us going forward. And then Mastering Marketing Agility, I wrote about 3 years later, and it sort of coalesces all of the hard lessons that I learned alongside my clients in that time to take those really challenging steps to do that, to put Agile really to work for marketers. So it's sort of a sequel.
Well, and you do touch a bit on the past in this one, for those of us that haven't read the first one, but I don't see how this is going to go away, this approach. I mean, certain aspects of it will come and go, but I don't see how it's not going to be around at least as long as you're working.
Absolutely. It really is the necessary modus operandi, I think, for any profession that needs to be responsive and immersed in the digital world. And marketing has no choice but to be both of those things. And so I think it's best practice, really, for the foreseeable future.
Yes. And I read that the foreword to your book was by Scott Brinker, author of Hacking Marketing. And I interviewed him on episode 63 back in March of 2016. And this episode is going to be episode 303, just before Seth Godin. So, you know, if we do this right, you know, we'll get the audience whipped into a frenzy for him. And, you know, as I recall in his book, which was just phenomenal, he talks about how a lot of the software world develops software. Once software could be delivered over the internet, they learned to iterate rather than try to get it perfect and ship a box once a year. They then started more of this agile approach. And then he explained, as I recall, that then marketers at software firms started to see how they were operating and started to realize that it made more sense for marketers. And now it's just building up a head of steam that's just never going to go away. And I wanted to read just an excerpt from his foreword. So in the foreword, he talks about how everything's going faster and faster and faster. And he says, I've got three pieces of good news for you. First, you're not alone. Everyone in marketing today is affected by the same dizzying changes and quickening cycle speeds. Everyone feels the sensation of being overwhelmed. It's not you. It's the industry. Second, the upside of working in this tumultuous, revolutionary period in marketing's history is that the opportunity to make an impact has never been greater. You are at the forefront of a whole new wave of marketing. If you're willing to experiment, learn, and adapt, you can unlock incredible value for your organization. And you can advance your career at a rate that people in other professions will admire and envy. Third, you've got a terrific guidebook for navigating that opportunity in your hands. Andrea is one of the true pioneers of agile marketing. She's wicked smart. I live in Boston, so that's the highest compliment we can give. She's amassed a ton of insight into agile transformations from having taught, coached, and consulted for hundreds of marketing teams. The price of this book is a steal for tapping her wisdom. And then I've got to quote from the preface. You write, "This is a book about how. It's not about why your company is in business or why someone should choose you or your primary competitor. It isn't about whom you should target. It doesn't tell you the right segments to approach or what your perfect persona might look like. It isn't about what marketing channels or tactics you need. It doesn't guide you to a perfect omni-channel strategy. It isn't here to help you blend artificial intelligence and machine learning into your marketing mix. It's about something greater than any of that. Mastering Marketing Agility is about how to make your marketing activities, all of them, better. Whatever your marketing looks like, the framework detailed here gets it flowing more smoothly. Whether you're business to business, business to consumer, business to government, an agency, or some beautiful hybrid of all of those, this book is here to make your marketing more predictable, productive, and sustainable." So, Andrea Ferrier, before we go much further, I guarantee there's somebody listening who's maybe he's heard of agile marketing, not familiar with it. What is it?
Well, aside from awesome, like I love Scott's intro. He's so awesome. But
he really is.
Agile in marketing, right, is this representation of like you were saying, the idea that we don't need to get something perfect and send it out once a year. We should be able to find a way to deliver value to our customers and to our audiences continually. And so that goes back to the way that we plan, the way that we design our work, the way that we structure teams, but it's all centered around this idea of continual delivery of value, learning what works, iterating on that, finding out what doesn't work, and running as fast as you can in the other direction. But it's value delivery constantly. And to help with that, there's, of course, the aspects of speed and productivity and efficiency that help us to achieve that. But we do all of those things in order to be the most valuable source of information possible to the customers and audiences that we as marketers are here to serve.
So I know this works for large marketing organizations. How small of an organization can this type of activity that you outline in your book be applied to?
You can be really, really tiny team and still make use of what's in the book and agility, you know, more broadly, even a scrum team, for instance, the sweet spot for that team is about 5 people. And so if you're just 5 people, then you're just one agile team who's working together to achieve their objectives. And you have one backlog and one nice, pretty Kanban board and all of those things. So you can be a really small team and still make it work. We are obviously an agile marketing team at Agile Sherpas. We only have 4 full-time employees, you know, outside of our coaches and consultants who aren't really doing day-to-day stuff for the business. So it's, you know, anybody really can make use of the practices.
Yes. And there was a concept that you explained, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, called work in progress. Doggone it. I started applying that to myself. And the problem is it works. So dang it, Freire. Here you're already getting me to make some changes. So at any rate, well, listen, there's a lot of, and I'm really flattered to say this, there's a lot of salespeople around the world who listen to this show. Obviously, they're very successful salespeople. And Andrea, as you may know, I have the most attractive audience in all of podcast land. So they're very good looking people too. But with those, all those sales professionals or CEOs listening in, is there anything in it for them? In other words, are there sales folks out there who maybe have worked in an organization where this methodology has been applied where they might have actually benefited or liked it?
100%. The phrase that I've heard used to describe marketing many times is it's the marketing black hole. You know, we send ideas in here, we send requests in there, and they never seem to come back out. And so for sales people, for executives who rely on marketing to support the larger activities and objectives of the organization, letting the marketing team own their process and use these agile ways of working helps you get the work back that you need in a way that's predictable and high quality. And so it's really kind of a win-win-win for everybody within and outside of marketing once the marketers themselves can start to fix their processes.
And, you know, I've had some books on the show over the years about sales and marketing alignment, and certainly that topic comes up quite a bit. And it seems like this is something that can beautifully help bake that into an organization's process of getting their sales and marketing better aligned.
Oh, it's so true. It's a beautiful thing when you start to have sales representation at planning events, right? And they're there to contribute items to the planning process and say, this is what we need from you in the next month, quarter, 2 weeks, whatever the planning cycle looks like. And then marketing to be able to have just a conversation with them, arrive at shared understanding about what needs to be done and when, and then we go and do it and bring it back to them in that short cycle. And again, as everybody's happy and you get that alignment without this, you know, fist fight breaking out over who's going to do what when and who dropped the ball and all of those things. So it's a really nice system for that alignment and not just for the marketing process itself.
Yes, it's like it sneaks a lot of really good communication into an organization that might not have been there in the past. Not that you're trying to be sneaky, but I see what you're doing there. So now there are a number of folks that I've already heard from who knew I was going to be interviewing you today, and they've asked some questions and we're going to play them. But I want to ask a question that might be on their minds, the people who are really familiar with agile marketing. Explain how this book is different from, say, the Agile Marketing Manifesto.
Mm-hmm. So The book outlines a new framework, which I've called remarketing, R-I marketing, and it's based on the Japanese concept of shu-ha-ri, which is this mapping of the path to mastery. And so you start in shu and you follow the rules and you do what you're told because you don't know if there are options beyond that. When you get into ha, you start to iterate around those rules. You kind of bend the rules a little bit. You're riffing on what you learned. And when you get to re, you're able to create something new. This was originally applied to martial arts, and a lot of people talk about dancers as the same kind of level of progression.
Well, let me interrupt. You say in the book that it's like that scene from the movie Grease where they're all dancing, hand jive. Please explain.
Right. So in Grease, you have Frenchie and Duty, right, where he has to count the waltz, and he's like, don't talk to me, I'm counting. I can only do the exact steps. And then there's some of the kids that during the hand jive, they're sort of making up their own little moves, and they do the clap, clap, fist, fist, thumb, thumb, you know, the same kind of thing.
But they kind of have the hang of it.
Right. They get it. They're on the beat. They don't have to count. Mm-hmm. And then you have Danny and Sandy who are just going crazy, right? They're still dancing. You can still recognize that they're doing the same sort of activity, but it's so much different. It's moving and responding to one another. And that's really what I hope is the remarketing framework in the book. It's this evolution beyond what's in something like the Agile Manifesto. We've spent our time following the rules, and now it's time to really break out of them and make Agile something that is tailor-made for the marketing profession.
Mm-hmm. Well, and before we jump into to more details, talk a bit about what you call the imperiled marketing executive and where they, I think every listener just perked up. Talk about the imperiled marketing executive and where they fit in with all this marketing revolution. And if you would, talk about the hourglass, because I don't think you mentioned this in the book, but when you talked about the hourglass, it reminded me of the Wizard of Oz. When the Wicked Witch turned the hourglass over and said to Dorothy, that's how long you have to live.
I had forgotten that scene. That's a good one. So yes, marketing executives have gotten into this bad habit of whenever they get hired somewhere, they embark on these huge Big Bang initiatives. The classic rebrand, we need a new website, these big projects to show it was a great idea to hire me. Here's all this amazing stuff that I'm about to do. But they're so nebulous and they take forever and everybody wants to have a say in it. And the scope creep, it just explodes and it takes ages and ages for any sort of value to be seen from those activities. And in the meantime, right, like you said, the hourglass has been flipped over and marketing executives have the shortest tenure of anyone in the C-suite. And so we feel this, right? After about 18 months, the new CMO starts to feel kind of twitchy because they haven't shown anything great happening yet. So then the flailing starts and they're, you know, is it this channel? Is it this campaign? Is it this initiative? And by the time any of those start to show value, you've hit that kind of 3-year mark, which is the time's up and off you go, next in line. And so for me, I've seen it happen for marketing executives who can break that cycle and come in and say, first things first, Agile. We're going to change our processes. We're going to improve our operations so that they can then start showing value with more iterative and customer-centric work within a couple of months. So now it's really easy to empirically prove the value that they are bringing as a new executive, as opposed to waiting for this kind of rebrand is over, I guess, and it was good because colors are nicer, right? So it's a,
Andrea, I'm laughing to keep from crying.
I know, right? And so it's quite beneficial for executives to start this as one of their first steps as part of a new place. And sometimes it seems less sexy than some of these other traditional Big Bang things, but ultimately everything that goes through that improved system is better. And so everything, even if you don't make many fundamental changes to how you market or the channels that you use, if you improve your operations, it all benefits from that uptick.
Mm. I've given a talk in the past about this idea of how to be the kind of marketer that every CEO wants to hire and can't afford to lose. This is the kind of book they need to be reading to add to that. And of course, I'll be taking you with me on many trips as I give this revised talk in the future whenever we can get back on airplanes. So in the book, you've got these seven principles. And I wanted to talk about some of the key points here because there is a lot of detail in the book and it's only 160 some pages long, which as somebody who gets to read a lot of these books, I say, good for you. It seems like it's much more difficult to write a 170-page book than a 370-page book. But there's a lot of detail, and we can't get into all of it. But the seven principles that I wanted to touch on a couple of these, they are customer focus, radical transparency, continuous improvement, adaptability, trust, a bias toward action, and courage. So I was, you know, it just warmed the cockles of my heart to see customer focus was the number one thing. And explain what customer focus, I think people may think, oh yeah, sure, we're focused on customers. No, I think there's more to it than that. And there certainly is in your book. Explain what is meant by customer focus, perhaps specifically talking about organizing marketing teams.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that particular part up because I think that's something that really can fundamentally transform the way that we do work and the way that we decide what work not to do, which is probably more important at this point.
Yes.
But to organize the teams in such a way that they are laser focused on customer value. I'm a big fan of doing it based on sort of stages of the customer journey. So we've got teams that are focused early, mid, and late so that they become super passionate about serving people at that stage in their journey. Mm-hmm. I've also seen teams do it based on persona, if you serve sort of distinct personas on the same project. But ultimately, that team or those agile teams exist to deliver value to that type of customer. And then as they get work requests in, as they're developing their OKRs or their KPIs or whatever acronym you like to use to measure the success of your work, they can use that as the filter to say, yes, this is an amazing opportunity to deliver value to our customer. That, however, is not going to be as useful. We can put it lower on the list or say, I'm sorry, that's not the right fit for what we do. And this ability to navigate requests based on whether or not they deliver value to that end customer gets us out of order taker mode as well. So it's not just, you know, we've got this huge pile of stuff and people just keep throwing things on it. We have the capability to take some stuff and take others away because they don't align with the customer-centric goal that we've set.
Every marketer listening, you just had them at order taker. I'm just Now, talk about the customers though, because you've got, I think, maybe three different broad categories of what a customer actually is or could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm a content marketing nerd from the way back.
Wait a minute. So, in the book, you also say you're a process nerd. So, you know, which one is it?
I'm just a nerd. So maybe it's kind of neutral.
Well, you found your home. Please go ahead.
I did. Yeah. And so I have to always think about kind of the audience more broadly too, because we need to be talking to people who may not be ready to buy right this moment, which is so much about what content marketing is that delivery of value with no expectation of a transactional relationship in the moment, right? Here's something great. Hope it helps you. Okay, thanks, bye. And eventually over time, the relationship builds and hopefully they come to be a passionate customer. And so knowing that you need to be speaking to those people, to people who are actually customers as well. And so to organize the teams in such a way that you can provide value across that kind of customer spectrum, I think is really important. And there's internal customers too, right? As marketers, we're very service focused. There are people who need things from us. So being able to prioritize those kinds of requests against our understanding of what the audience needs is an important skill for an agile marketer to develop.
Right. So you talk about what I think could be described as marketing malpractice, actually several places in the book. But one of them, this isn't the first time I've read about it or seen it done wrong, and that's as it relates to buyer personas. and they're important, but it sounds like you've seen a lot of companies go a little bit overboard. What then is a minimum viable persona?
Yeah. I mean, my very first getting job, when I came in and they're acclimating me to everything, they open a drawer, right, and pull out like the persona binder, and they're kind of fraying around the edges and they're old. And I'm like, are these are who I need to write for? You know, I was hired as a content marketer. They're like, well, sort of, but it's not really this guy anymore. Like, we changed his name and he's not this role anymore, but we paid so much to have these made and printed. We don't want to change that. And so it's this weird sacred artifact somehow. So instead, right, thinking about, what do we need to know to communicate with these people effectively? Let's start there. It's that idea of test, learn, iterate, which is at the heart of agility, and just apply it to your personas. You know, what do you already know? How can you deliver value based on that? And then how can you run some experiments to learn more about those people and what they really want? Instead of spending, you know, 6 to 9 months on focus groups and surveys and all of the things that we do to create this document that we don't ever want to touch because we just spent this huge amount of time and money on it.
And yet you talk about how it's still difficult for a lot of marketers to get any information on their customers. And I'm not sure that it seems to me that some of that blame lies at the marketer's feet. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that we can get so fixated on our own navel gazing, right? Every week I write an article, I send an email newsletter, I, you know, communicate on this channel in this way, and we just churn through these same activities. And we don't ever look back up and say, does anyone care? Is anyone engaging with this? I think it's Anne Hanley that said, you know, if your newsletter went away this tomorrow, would anyone care? Would anyone write to you and go, hey, I missed your newsletter in my inbox? And most of us is probably no. So I think that it is on us to get into that more customer-centric place and to take the time, right? And this is all comes back to the limit your work in progress, create more slack in your day so that you have that moment to go, hey, how could I connect with these people better? How could I provide more value instead of just, okay, urgent item number one, check. Now let's move on to urgent item number two.
Yes. And I would urge all marketers to become, if the opportunity is available, you can become the expert on your customers. And I've seen a lot of marketing people do extremely well when they've taken their own initiative. They've taken responsibility for getting deeper insights into their customers without having been told to, and mm-hmm. it really raises their profile. That's just but what I've seen. So radical transparency, again, it probably means different things to different people, but talk about the kind of transparency that is required in Agile versus what we may have seen in past traditional marketing departments or organizations.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so much about the power of agile frameworks comes down to transparency and visibility. You can see in the olden days, see sometimes from sticky notes on a wall, right? Physically see things that represent how much work is being done and what stage of work it's in and who's doing it and all these important things about it. And then and only then can we decide if that's the right work. Is that really the most important thing? If it is, let's rally around. And if not, let's cut it so we can focus on the most important things. And when you say it out loud like that, it doesn't sound like this extraordinary thing. But I was on a course this morning with senior leadership from a big bank, and they're trying to get started with this. And one of them was saying, my team is really nervous about it because they feel like it's policing, right? That they were just checking up on them all the time. And so it's a hard shift to make, but really it's there to help the folks doing the work to say, hey, you've got 20 things on your plate today alone. Let me take a look at that and tell you, and I've seen marketing leaders do this, let me take a look at that and tell you, hey, 15 of those, I don't care about. I want you doing only these five. And it's such a lift of a burden, right? To be like, okay, it's five now and not 20. But you can't do that unless everyone can see it and we can have an honest conversation about what's planned and what's being deprioritized.
Yes. And because I had the benefit of having just read your book, I got a quote from page 34. You say, some marketers spend their careers hiding behind busyness. They're good at moving, but less good at delivering results. Others are territorial, preferring to tend to their little corner rather than ensuring larger team success. Still others lack necessary job skills and have become adept at concealing that fact. So another thing that came to mind was like the transparency that an organization starts to see when there's insights throughout the sales pipeline, like when marketing can see whether the leads are being followed up on, and likewise sales can look back and see, you know, how a lead was generated. It seemed it just reminded me of that when you talked about this radical transparency.
Yeah, and it's a great opportunity for marketing to kind of lead the way into this better business agility future. Mm-hmm. So we can see that customer's journey from their entire life cycle. And yeah, it's every aspect of where the customer touches, and you can start to bring in, you know, customer service or support if you have those folks as well, so that everybody's agile. We can see this whole flow of a person and start to smooth out the delivery of value across the whole system. But marketing touches so many other aspects of the customer journey and of the organization that we're a great sort of entry point into agile ways of working too.
Well, Andrea, I have to admire what you do in your day job, because you are all about change. And it's terrifying for organizations. And it just had me wondering, is this transparency one of the biggest fears that organizations have that you are dealing with, or is it some other areas?
No, I think you're on the right track. The transparency issue is a tough one, you know, for many of the reasons you read in that quote. And I think also for leaders who may or may not be sure that their teams are doing the right thing. You know, they're doing their best most of the time, and they're just not sure. They have limited information, or they're not as able to keep track of everything as they wish they were. And they're worried that if all of that comes to light, it's going to be laid at their feet. So better not to shine the light in the corners. But, you know, if everybody can come together and agree on the reasons why we're doing this, and this is one of the reasons why trust is another one of the principles there. If we can all trust, we've so far been doing the best we can with what we have, and we're going to build a better system together, then you can start to overcome some of that trepidation. It takes a while, and you know, you have to create these spaces for things like psychological safety, where we can raise our hands and say, that's not right, and this could be better, without fear that somebody's going to slap us on the wrist.
Andrew, just so you know, you're freaking me out, because you're clearly reading my screen, because I was going to jump over the next two and say, well, let's talk about trust, and specifically, what is psychological safety?
So psychological safety is essentially this idea that it is safe to speak up. People within a team feel that there won't be negative ramifications if they bring up hard topics.
Okay, now you didn't just come up with this. This was the result in part of a big study by Google, I think it was?
That's right, yeah. So it's Dr. Amy Edmondson coined the term psychological safety, and then Google did a big study, Project Aristotle is what they called it, looking at thousands of their own teams to see like what makes an awesome team. What are the characteristics? Obviously for Google, then they want to know how can we make more of the awesome teams. But what they discovered was it's not who the leader is. It's not even how well qualified or experienced the people on the teams are. It's whether or not they have this psychological safety and whether or not they feel confident speaking up in front of one another. And that was the most common factor, which is just like kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. Because that's replicable. You know, you may not be able to create the dream team over and over again, but you can create that and give all sorts of teams a real boost.
Mm. Well, in that section, and one of the sections on trust, I want to ask you to explain this, because this just jumped off the page at me. And you wrote, marketing to serve, not sell, is the only viable way to approach our profession in the 21st century.
Yeah, nobody wants to be sold to anymore. I read a lot of hilarious sort of anecdotes about the old days of advertising when I was researching Death of a Marketer, and they seem so quaint and hilarious now, but that was the way to get people to buy your things, you know, and it's not all that long ago that we were resorting to those tactics as marketers, and nobody's into it now. And I think somehow we forget that, like, we are marketed to all the time, and we get annoyed and we post on LinkedIn, I can't believe so-and-so gave me this cold LinkedIn reach out. And, you know, we get annoyed at the tactics, but then when we're back in the marketer seat, we're like, yes, email blast all the people. and we forget what it's like. So it's coming back to this idea that in order to be successful, we have to be a partner in a conversation and a valuable contributor to people's day. And that's the only way we're going to get engagement. That's the only way we're going to achieve anything. And we have to be in that for the long haul too. It's not a one night stand. This is a long-term relationship that we're trying to establish with people, and it's harder, but that's really like the only way to get it done.
Don Draper's not there anymore. And no. It's true, Andrea, it wasn't too long ago, because in the 1980s, I was working on Madison Avenue in New York City at some of the biggest ad agencies in the world, and it did work. And I like to say, if it still worked, I'd still be doing it. But now I'm, you know, in the content marketing world. So a lot of the trust that you talk about, for me, it really resonated when you talked about goals. And mm-hmm. you've got to understand what the organization is trying to accomplish. What does one do in the case of an organization with ill or undefined goals and objectives? And I ask that, and maybe I'm dealing with smaller companies than you, but I run into a lot of companies that just don't have any kind of goals that we can even scratch out to see if we might even be able to help them. Have you run into companies like that?
Yes, a shocking number, truth be told.
Oh, I feel better.
Yeah.
the healing begin.
I was kind of like, do I just get the most broken companies coming to me? But no, it's kind of really shocking of how often that happens. And you know, marketing leaders ask me that, you know, what if we don't know? What if we don't know what the organizational goals are? How do we make sure we're serving a purpose? And, you know, there's a principle in designing a Kanban board of focusing only on the parts of the system you can control. And I think in some ways, marketers have to do that. If you don't know, if the organization either hasn't designed the goals or hasn't communicated them properly, or almost worse, they change every other week, mm-hmm. then you have to control what you can control, right? And as marketing, hopefully that is the maintenance and building of relationships with customers and the audience. So go do that, right? Focus on delivering value, focus on also measuring and proving the value of what you are doing, so that whenever hopefully the organization gets its act together and brings you a set of objectives, you can either say, okay, great, here's how what we're already doing supports that, or here's what we've been doing so far and how we'll plan to make these adjustments to support you. And you can be a really productive member of that conversation.
So if they don't have the goals, then what are the kinds of things a marketing person could be doing? Because I guess in my reading of it, I don't know, it's this fantasy of mine of wanting to know what an organization's trying to accomplish and what their measurable goals are and so forth. But if they can't, like, let's say it's like they are working for a lot of the companies that I've been chatting with recently, where I'll talk to the marketing people and they don't really know, and maybe the organization doesn't have any goals. What then should somebody be trying to do if they're trying to go in this direction?
Yeah. Some of it, I think, comes back to what type of an organization are you in, right? I've worked with a lot of B2B folks. And so it's, you know, the sales qualified lead is kind of the holy grail. And so even if you don't have anything beyond that, you know, it's hard, because what I was about to say was just like, get the systems in place, get the processes in place,
sure.
so that whenever you've got the goal, you're ready, you know, like on your market set, go, you're ready to go. But it's hard to be motivated to do that if you don't know what you're trying to achieve. So, you know, I would say probably instead, I mean, there's got to be perhaps it's a parallel path, right? Where you're kind of the doers, the people responsible for the execution of work are optimizing that as much as they can, while senior marketing leaders are really pushing for that to say, hey, we're setting up this agile system and we want to test it against some really hefty, hard to achieve goals. Do you got any? Like, give us something to shoot for.
Mm.
And maybe that's the conversation that needs to happen. But yeah, that's a tough one. It's tough when you get into that situation.
Mm. Well, Andrea Ferrier, why do marketers need to get better at saying no?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's. Let me count the ways.
It brought to mind that song from Oklahoma, "I'm Just the Girl Who Can't Say No."
I'm just a girl who can't say no. I'm in a terrible fix. I always say, "Come on, let's go," just when I ought to say, "Nick."
But it's such a compelling point, and actually. Is it true that if you are able to pursue this approach, you are actually able to say no more?
Yes, because you've got the customer-centric filter, like we talked about before, and then you also have kind of a process scapegoat in some ways, where if you're running sprints, let's say, we've sat down and we've said, for the next 2 weeks, here's the subset of all of our work that we've agreed to focus on to deliver some value. And then when people come and say, hey, look at this brilliant article that I just read, go and do this thing, you can say, I'm sorry, we're in the middle of a sprint. Please put that into our backlog and we'll prioritize that idea against everything else we could possibly be doing next sprint. And so it's not, that's dumb, we're not going to do it. It's, we are focused on this work right now. Please, you know, document your request and we'll get to it. And so it's focus. You know, it's this idea of finding the value, lasering in on it, and doing only that until it's done, and then moving on to the next thing. And it's so counterintuitive, but it's the most powerful thing, in my opinion, about how agile systems work.
Just to add to that, Andrea Ferrier, this agile approach is the perfect antidote to Management by InFlight magazine. And that's when the boss reads some in-flight magazine over the weekend. They come in and they say, all right, I know we're an industrial boiler manufacturer, but I want to put it all in TikTok. What is your TikTok strategy? And you can say, okay, interesting. Yeah, let's. And if you can just let it blow over for at least a few minutes, it's going to blow over completely. But in this case, yeah, you do have a bit of a process scapegoat. But I would argue it's a good process scapegoat. Now, in the book, you also reveal where some of the biggest landmines are. what are you call them anti-patterns? So, what is an anti-pattern, and what are some of these check engine light warnings that we should be mindful of?
Yeah, I mean, the anti-pattern is basically do not enter. You're going the wrong way. This is not the approach.
Danger.
Yeah, warning. And so there are several. Early on, one of the things that I hear from almost every call that I get on with marketing leaders who are considering this is, well, let's just do it around a project. Help us find the right project to try this out. And then we'll just put people, they'll be like 15% of their time on Agile, and we'll see if it's going to work. And it's antithetical to so many of those values. And a massive watch out for any marketer who's trying to figure their way into this, right? How am I going to try it? Don't test around a project. Mm-hmm. I can't say it enough times, because what happens is, okay, the five of us are going to go and sit and 15% of our time, we're going to try this agile thing out. But it's a mindset. It's a different way of thinking, right? It's trust. It's transparency. It's hard conversations, but only do that 15% of your time. Then like turn your brain, your agile brain off, turn your regular brain back on and go do your regular work for 85% of the time, you're not going to get any of the benefit. Not to mention that all the agile frameworks and practices are meant to work with one stable, intact team, not a project that you do for a tiny fraction of your work life.
Right. And at the end of the book, you have a section on piloting something is important, but you can pilot it wrong and run it right into the ground. And as I recall it, you talk about some of that where you've got, you know, the bosses, some of their people are being pulled into this thing. So you get the turf issue and then they're not really doing it right, but they think they are. And it probably brings you to tears. But that kind of brings us to what is the peskiest and most powerful part of agile systems?
Mm-hmm. Those are the people, definitely.
Damn it. If we just didn't have the people.
Right? Systems design would be so much easier if there weren't people in them. But I mean, this is something supporting people as humans, you know, as we go through, like you mentioned, change is hard and most of us will avoid it actively if we can. And knowing that about people and getting comfortable having hard conversations and making them feel like, hey, we're not coming in and telling you that you've been doing this wrong this whole time, but we're finding a better way forward, not a repudiation of everything that you've been trying for the last however long your marketing career has been.
Yeah. At one part, you write, one of the most defective parts of traditional marketing organizations is the way we've been setting up teams. Can you talk about some of the things that are the biggest problems for setting up teams and then how they just really don't work with agile?
Yeah, it's these project teams, you know, where we bring people together in this, go accomplish this small output, right? Do this small thing as a group of people centered around a project. I even hesitate to use the word team because I just don't think it's quite accurate.
Well, it brings to mind for me the party planning committee in the TV show The Office.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. And their goals as the party planning committee are oftentimes in conflict with the goals of themselves as the accountant or the office manager or whatever else. And so we set them up for these internal conflicts. And we do the same thing with our quote unquote project teams, where I need to go and write this new fancy ebook for a sales enablement project. But then I also have blog posts and press releases and all these other things that my functional boss is, you know, tapping my shoulder and saying, hey, is this finished? I need you to work on this. But then my other projects that I'm a member of are like, hey, we're behind, we're missing deadlines, where are you at? And so we're just pulled in all these directions and we end up like huddled under our desk, worried nothing's going to get done. And it's really dysfunctional and not conducive to professional satisfaction.
Yeah. Let's step back a second though and explain what you mean when you talk about the what and the how cycles, those two circles that sometimes interconnect.
Yeah. And this helps get us away from that order taker mentality because we rely on marketing leadership to tell us the what. What's important? What are the objectives? What's the ultimate destination we're trying to drive this bus to? And then we free up the marketers themselves to be the owners of the how. Here's where we're trying to go. Here, we're all in the bus. Let's get going. And we can be agile in our ways of getting there, right? Well, we thought we were going to take this highway, but it turns out that it's under construction. So take the exit, take the side road, go around, instead of being delivered with the super specific drive this road at this speed for this long and then change lanes because there's a stalled car, right? Which is the equivalent of the super crazy detailed brief of landing page, this many words, this call to action, this color banner, like all the things of the really prescriptive order. So it separates these out and it asks people who are bringing us requests to tell us what they want, like not how to do it, but what are you trying to achieve? Let us exercise our subject matter expertise to help you get there, but recognize that we might have some good ideas here too.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, did you draft this book before the end of the first quarter when the global pandemic struck?
Yes. Yes. It was complete. The final draft finished in January. So yes, it was done pre-pandemic.
Okay. Having established that, I have to quote from this and ask how this has been affected or received in light of the pandemic. You write, as it relates to employees being near each other physically, co-location and face-to-face interaction deliver far superior results. The trend toward remote work, flexible schedules, and distributed teams have made this sentiment unfashionable in the last 5 years, but there's no getting around it. A single five-minute conversation can do more to unblock a project than dozens of emails. How has that, so you must have been getting a lot of pushback on that beforehand. What wrinkle has the pandemic put into that?
Yeah, I did get pushback on it prior to even all the lockdown stuff. But it's been quite an interesting period for me because I spent most of my time prior to March face-to-face with clients and, you know, talking and learning with them. And obviously, I haven't been doing that. And it's all been on Zoom and whatnot. I would still strongly adhere to the latter half of that statement about a five-minute conversation can save us dozens of emails. Still very much think that's true. But I would walk the first part of it probably back a little bit in terms of actual physical co-location is not as important as I thought it was, having experienced all of this now.
The listener understands you do write that it's just not always possible and that there are some ways, you know, using Zoom or video, there are some ways to do that. But even then, if you can, get folks together a few times a year if you can.
Yes. Even those occasional touch points are really important. And I've spoken with a lot of marketing leaders since lockdown about how are you doing this? How are you navigating interpersonal relationships amongst your team once they're not together? And it makes a difference if you were together physically before lockdown and then you had to suddenly distribute versus those that were distributed and that was just the way that they were. But ultimately, I think it comes down to there's an agile value in the manifesto of individuals and interactions over processes and tools. So if we lean into that and just say allowing people the space to interact effectively, knowing that most of the time that means being able to see another human's face while we're talking because we respond really well to facial cues, then that's our preference. And if that's in a room together, great. If that has to be on Zoom, we'll make it work.
Mm. So we've talked about processes, we've talked about people, we've talked about the principles. Just I want to briefly touch on the practices. And, you know, it's very granular. We're not going to be able to go into it all. And I think it would really do injustice to the book to try to go into great granularity because you really need to read those parts. But I found it interesting when you wrote, let's see, part four is called Practices, Daily Activities for Achieving Lasting Agility. And then you write, when I was writing this book, it was hard, really hard, to avoid jumping straight into this material. The specific team-level practices described here hold the keys to so much amazing transformation that I wanted to write about it right away. I have, however, a very good reason for writing about practices last. Andrea, why did you want to write about practices last rather than what you really wanted to jump into?
Yeah, the other components are crucial to making those practices work the way that they're intended. And if you dive straight into practices as a practitioner, as well as a person writing about them in a
and
book.
Anybody likes to do that. Marketers,
I know,
they want to know the latest tactic or the latest tool.
Yes, they're the shiny parts of the car.
Squirrel. But if you
don't, yeah, exactly.
That's a joke that's in her book about squirrel.
But if you don't have a strong engine, then the car won't go anywhere. And so it was useful for me to force myself to focus on those early parts first, just like I emphasize with our clients, like build the foundation very first thing, and then your practices will have a good place to start from. One of my favorite examples is people who jump into using something like daily stand-up, which is a standard agile practice where a team gets together for 15 minutes every morning to talk about what they did yesterday, what they're going to do today, and what impediments or blocks they have encountered with the goal of collaborating on high value work to get it over the finish line. But if you don't know that last part, the reason that stand-up exists, which is down to that transparency value, which is down to that bias to action, all of these foundational concepts, if you don't know that, and you just have your team stand up and talk at each other for 15 minutes every morning about their to-do list, you're like, well, that didn't work. Why would people do this? And so
we tried that agile thing.
Right?
It don't work.
It's not good. And so you have to get to a place where you understand the reason behind the practices before you can make them work the way that they're intended to.
Right. And do you deal with a lot of companies that want to rush off and buy a software tool before they start to do all this, what's in your book first?
Yes, sometimes. I think we're getting better at this as marketers. Like, we've stopped relying on the tool to solve all of our problems, thankfully.
It's because they don't normally.
They really don't. And for agile marketing in particular, if you get in that mismatched order, you end up trying to retrofit your processes to match a tool, which is terrible. And then you get stuck and it's bad.
Yeah, it's like joining a health club at the beginning of the year to get in shape and lose weight. Andrea, it turns out you actually have to go to the club and use it. I thought that just by buying that gym membership, it would take care of all my problems. So,
if only.
You know, if you don't work for an organization that adopts this, although I can't imagine a marketer who's not going to be pulled into this and need to know about this, or maybe change jobs, and this is going to be basically the operating system. This one thing could work for you regardless of what you do, and that's what I mentioned earlier, the work in progress limits. Kind of related to multitasking and the fallacy that brings about, but explain what you mean when you say that by doing less at any given time, we can ultimately accomplish more.
Yes. This is my, like, if you're going to do anything after you have listened to me talk about nerdy agility for an hour here, go try work in progress limits. They are magical. And it's essentially one thing at a time. No multitasking. Look at the to-do list that you've got and do the most important thing on it until that thing is done. Then and only then do you start on the next thing. And that works for individuals. It's pretty easy to do as an individual, but it works for teams even as well, where we can say, as an agile team of five, we will never work on more than four things at a time. We need to put ourselves together and tackle this one thing as a unit until it's done. Great. If we're going to kind of spread ourselves out and each of us is working on one thing at a time, that works too. But never will we have 20 things active at any given moment. Because what happens, right, is we have to split our time in between all those things. And so if we had an hour of productive time today and we have 20 things in progress, you see where this is going, right? It's like 3 minutes for each of those things.
Oh, I've seen how this movie ends, Andrea.
Yeah. We've all sat there. It's a sad, sad ending to that movie. But if we instead had one thing that we were going to work on and it only took us 20 minutes once we had focused effort to apply to it, great, it's done. Move on to the next thing. That's what people, I think, misunderstand, is they think what I'm saying is all you can do all day is one thing. That's rarely how our days go. So one thing at a time, that extrapolates then out to the team level. And so it's individual productivity, team productivity, and it just explodes the number of things that we're able to accomplish. And you have to actually see it in practice, I think, sometimes to believe it. But it is totally a thing. Just give it a try. And it's this magical moment when it starts to work.
You're right that on my personal Kanban board, I have a strict in-progress limit of 2. And I bump up against it practically every day. Moving on, I know this is really important in the agency world, but why does estimation remain a controversial topic in the agile world? And of course, that's all related into, you know, keeping track of hours and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. we're just bad. Humans are bad at estimation. We always think, oh yeah, 30 minutes and I'll knock that out. And then it's, you know, 4 hours later and we're still struggling with it. And so using hours is tricky for that reason. And in the agile world, there's a slight preference for estimating effort, right? So what's something super easy that's not complicated, it's super predictable, that's a one. And then we use that as kind of our baseline for looking at everything else. So here's our super easy, writing an email is a one. Well, now that I have to write a blog post, is that five times harder? Okay, that's a five. Is it eight times harder? Well, that's an eight. And maybe for me, it's only five times harder because I'm a content marketer, but we have our SEO specialist who wants to get better at writing. And so she's going to jump in and take that task. But for her, it's an eight, right? Because that's harder for her. She's not as fast as me. So, you know, that's a related factor in there as well. And so it comes down to just being able to accurately commit to a certain amount of work in a certain amount of time. And that's really what we're looking for with estimation. And it's hard to do and we get it wrong a lot, but if we can use it as a guideline, the line from Pirates of the Caribbean, right? It's more like a guideline. then that's where estimation can help us out and prevent us from overcommitting. That's really what it's there for.
But not treating it as the, like the gospel of our next estimating effort.
Right. And it's not a stick, you know, with which to beat the team and make them go faster.
Last question about the book. Now, I mentioned it's a shorter book, and part of that may be because it doesn't have a lot of case studies, but this was very intentional. Why is your book light on case studies?
So I get asked for case studies all the time. Unfortunately, what I think people mean when they say they want a case study is they want like a checklist. Show me an organization with the same number of people that markets the same type of product, and I'm going to do exactly what they did in this order in the exact way that they did. But it never is a one-to-one translation. Your culture might be different. Your people are definitely different. Your tool stack is going to be different. And all those things are going to impact the way that Agile rolls out for you. And so I tell a couple kind of stories in the book, but I try to keep it higher level because I'm resistant to this idea of case studies as either the perfect roadmap that I'm going to follow unthinkingly, right? And without any kind of critical examination.
Which is what I want to do. I don't want to have to think.
Right. No thinking. No one likes that. Or if it doesn't exist, if there is no case study of a company just like mine, well, that means it won't work for me. And that's my excuse not to act, which is just so silly, right? Like that's the best excuse. That means you're going to gain a huge competitive advantage, perhaps by being one of the first in your space, like the best excuse to go. So I struggled with it and landed there. Maybe some of your listeners can tell me what they think about that ultimate decision, but that's the reasoning behind that anyway.
Oh, you know, you're an expert on agile marketing, but I have a feeling you spend even more hours a day dealing with like human problems. like you're a high school guidance counselor or something, trying to get these people to work through these issues because your book explains exactly how to do it. You know what else that brings to mind is a book by Jay Akunzo called Break the Wheel.
I love Jay.
Yes. And his book, very interesting. And, you know, he's such a phenomenal writer. And it was all about how following best practices is rarely a good idea because what worked for one other organization is not really going to work for you there if you copy it slavishly, like you're trying to steer people away from. So anyway, that came to mind. Okay, so Andrea, there have been a couple of listeners that knew I was going to be interviewing you, and they asked a few questions they wanted to know of you. And so that everybody can do this in future episodes, what I do is about a week before I interview an author, I post a picture of the book that I'm reading on LinkedIn. So if we're not connected on LinkedIn, let's connect there and you can see what I'm reading. And then folks are saying, oh, ask her this, you know, ask him that. Now, both of these listeners have also sent me an email with a recording of their questions. So we're going to play them now. And let's start with Mariana Wichenevsky from Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Hi, this is Mariana from Brazil, and I'd like to hear Andrea's opinion on how to manage a new leadership that doesn't know the objective of using agility in the marketing department, and also a leadership that doesn't understand the reason of using Kanban or to have dedicated teams per project and to be oriented by data and results.
Mariana, thank you very much for your question. Andrea, what do you think?
You know, I've seen this happen multiple times. The interesting thing is when Agile is already in place and new leadership comes in and doesn't really get it. So much of it is about putting our marketing hat back on and kind of looking at what's in it for them. No, not necessarily trying to make the case for Agile because we like it or because this is the way that we believe is the right way to work.
Or that it's what all the cool kids are doing.
It is what all the cool kids are doing, but sometimes CEOs don't care about that. Right. To say, you know, what's the problem that you want to solve with marketing? What's the benefit that you're looking for marketing to give you? Is it faster delivery? Is it more clear connection to the data? Do you want to have better transparency into what we're doing? Do you want us to make sure that we're aligned to your OKRs? Like, what's the why behind the ask here? And then stop arguing for Agile, right? And start arguing for the system you have that will deliver the value they want. Because some people get a bad taste in their mouth about Agile. They've kind of had a bad experience at some point or another. And so they're like, don't do that. Don't do that thing. So you can rebrand, you know, keep your marketing hat on, rebrand. And, oh, well, our iterative system allows us to test and learn faster. Here's what we can do for you because we have an iterative system. Or if you're more of a Kanban style, right, you can say, well, we focus on continuous flow and cutting out waste. And do you not want us to cut out waste? Because we can put the waste back and you know, think through why they're really asking for or why they're pushing back against Agile and rebrand, put your marketer hat on. And, you know, there's so many good things in the Agile way of working. It's almost impossible not to find one argument that people won't get behind.
That is great advice, even if you're not doing Agile. I mean, any kind of thing a marketing person's doing, the more that you can step back and start to do what Andrea was just doing, which was speaking C-suite. She didn't include any acronyms or buzzwords. I mean, you go in there and who other than the military perhaps has more acronyms and buzzwords than marketers? And they the C-suite, they could be a little bit mistrustful. You know, they tend to trust the more, you know, like the CFOs more than the marketing people by and large. And they just don't understand a lot of this marketing. You come in with like a new, what sounds like a new buzzword. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee most of them are thinking, oh no, here we go again. Okay. But instead, if you're, same thing in sales, if you're able to figure out what they're trying to accomplish, you can use this approach. Just don't use the A word. And I'm talking Agile. I'm kidding. Andrew. I don't mean to upset you there. Let's go to another question from Anthony Coppage from the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
A question that I'd love to hear Andrew answer. If velocity is not the point of agility, how do you temper expectations when clients hear or believe that the whole point of Agile is speed?
Anthony, thank you for your question. Andrew, what do you think?
Expectation setting is very important there. And kind of what we were talking about with the last question is the why behind Agile for the team itself. And oftentimes speed and productivity are a great byproduct of Agile, but ultimately making sure that it's clear that we are changing the way that we work in order to deliver value. And that's value to the customer, value to the audience, value to the business as well. And we want to do that faster, but doing crappy work faster is not going to help us. We need to do the right work. And in that way, we have to focus on other parts of the Agile system, like prioritization and transparency, as opposed to speed alone, because that's not going to get the results that we're looking for as a marketing function and as an organization.
Right. You can develop high speed and run right off the road. Do you think that a lot of your clients or the organizations you deal with, is speed one of the top things they think they're going to get from this?
I think it used to be. You know, in the past 9 months, there's been a greater tendency for people to talk about adaptability and responsiveness, just because the world has been, you know, changing right under our feet all the time. And so the understanding that Agile allows us to take that uncertainty and roll with it, I think, has become the more common driving factor.
Well, that's good. That's good, I would think.
I agree.
So, Andrea, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Work in progress limits. Go forth and use them all the time.
So I was on to something.
You are totally on to something. It's easily my favorite Agile practice.
Oh, boy. Well, that's probably the one that got me most excited. And how do you know I got excited? Because I was reading this to some colleagues during a morning stand-up meeting on Zoom, of course. But yes, really struck home with me. What is one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book?
You know, the WIP limits are great. They work better when you already have an understanding of what you could be doing. So go build a backlog also, right? Which is like your to-do list, but ruthlessly prioritized. Most important stuff up at the top, even if they're hard and scary. Most important things go at the top, and we go tackle those first, which makes the backlog work harder than a regular old to-do list.
You know, that's almost easier to say than to do, but it's worth trying to do. I already started tweaking my personal list that I've been, you know, that I have on the one of my screens all the time. So, aside from Hacking Marketing by Scott Brinker, what books have most inspired your work and career? And I don't know if that was going to be one of them, but it's certainly, I wouldn't be surprised if you mentioned it.
Yeah, I love Hacking Marketing. Other ones that I have really built on, I think, in over the course of my career, Epic Content Marketing by Joe Polizzi.
Oh, yes.
It's just like changed my life. Love that book so much when I was a brand new content marketer trying to figure out what am I supposed to be doing here?
And for those people playing the Marketing Book Podcast trivia game, that was episode 3 in January of 2015. For those playing the home game.
For those with their bingo boards out. Yes. And interestingly, you know, as an entrepreneur as well, I read the 4-Hour Work Week back in the day when it was first out. And I really thought that's what I wanted, was some sort of business that would allow me to not work. I've since discovered that I hate that.
And why do you say that?
I like working. I love my job so much now because I want to go to work. I want to do what I do, which is help people.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of the nerdy version of helping people with process and systems optimization. But just seeing how the impact that has on people, I want to work way more than 4 hours a week. So it was good to like recognize that not working is not the goal that I want to work towards. So it was kind of a, oh, good to know that doesn't work for me kind of moment.
Yeah. So it got you closer to where you did want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The other one is Personal Kanban. Those of you that are like looking to apply some of the WIP limits and backlogs and prioritization for your own personal productivity, that book is transformative to really show you how to do that at a personal level. And, you know, kind of pro tip, that's how I convinced my first ever marketing team to let me transform them when I first discovered agility, was by doing it for myself. And they saw how much less stressed and how much more productive I was as an individual contributor. And then they're like, all right, well, it can't be that bad. So let's try it.
Oh, wow. I just looked it up after I've already been waxing on about this work in progress. And so this book came out in around 2011, Personal Kanban, Mapping Work, Navigating Life. That's the one, right?
Yep, that's it.
Oh, terrific. That is great. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard about that you're looking forward to reading or seeing come out?
You know, I'm kind of late to the party, but I just finished Radical Candor.
Yeah, which, I was thinking about that book when I was reading about radical transparency in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely some inspiration from that book in there. So I'm a huge been that's been really useful and applicable with my work leading my own team and working with marketing leaders. So that's one that, like I said, I recently finished and have. It's one of those where, like, as you're reading it, I feel like I'm underlining every other paragraph. Like, oh yes, I have to do that, and this is just amazing. So that one yes. too.
Oh, terrific. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, your site, your personal site, your LinkedIn profile, and links to all these books. And I hope that listeners will, you know, reach out and connect with you and thank you for being on the podcast, because I can only imagine there are so many companies that are in desperate need of Andrea time, because they'll read this or you're working with all of them and there's so many things where I could just imagine that you're having to spend a lot of time getting these folks headed in the right direction. So, and for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found right now by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Mastering Marketing Agility, Transform Your Marketing Teams and Evolve Your Organization. The author is Andrea Freire. Andrea, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
It's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, I would like to return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I will drop it in the mail to you. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on this show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.